Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
I was born in Buffalo, New York, but we left there while I was still a baby, and then I was raised pretty much in Maryland, first Baltimore, and then down on the Eastern Shore on what they call the Delmarva Peninsula. So that's where I went to primary grade school and then high school, and started in radio while I was living there. And as a matter of fact, I lived in a little town called Jesterville. Maybe it was a population of about 100 or 200, but it was about 20 miles from the nearest town of any size. In fact, the only city on the Delmarva Peninsula on the eastern shore of Maryland, which was Salisbury. And so I started as a ventriloquist when my voice changed. My folks gave me a dummy when I was about 13, and I started doing community entertainments there in that rural area. And that led to my going on an amateur show at that radio station in Salisbury, 20 miles away, and I won first prize on an amateur contest, and that got me on the roster of the variety artists that the radio station sometimes called upon to appear at various functions like Lions Clubs and that sort of thing. So the chief announcer, program manager, would usually be the MC. So I talked to him on one of those occasions when I was being hired for the sum of $5 or $7.50 to go some 30 miles away, take a bus ride to appear at one of these functions. I talked to him about the possibility of my getting my own little radio show, and he said, "What did you have in mind?" And I said, "A situation comedy. I play the harmonica, and maybe something, some repartee humor with the ventriloquist dummy character." So a couple of weeks later, they gave me my own little slot every Monday night, and I would ride up to Salisbury with the school teachers who lived in that city and taught at the rural school where I was still a high school student. I was about 15 then. So then I'd ride up with them and stay overnight with an aunt. She lived out not far from the radio station. And so I didn't make any money, but it was a good experience. It developed into a situation comedy in which I played all the characters, a one-man show, wrote it, eventually dropped the harmonica bit and just did the multi-character voice thing and kind of a situation comedy. I was influenced in those days listening to such radio shows as Fibber McGee and Molly and Jack Benny and Fred Allen and so forth. And so that was a great influence on what I try to do in my own small way. Well, when I graduated from high school, I went back to Baltimore and studied acting there. Did a little theater work and some radio work, acting. I was never a staff announcer. And then the Army called, I was drafted, and I took the dummy with me, put him in a uniform, and we did a lot of entertaining while I was in.
What was the dummy's name?
Woody. Well, he started out being called Kentworth, I don't know why, Kentworth DeFrost. I eventually changed his name to Woody DeForest. And so the Army brought me to the West Coast. Prior to that, New York and legitimate theater had been my mecca. Although I had this voice, trick voice facility, I really wanted to be a legitimate character actor, Broadway. So I liked California and decided to stay after I got out of the service. Came to Hollywood. That was in 1946, September of 46. And, well, I started making the rounds. I was not a very aggressive type of person, so it was hard for me to push myself, sell myself. Radio was just at its peak, and I guess almost about to take the big nosedive. And within a few months, I auditioned for and got a part on a radio series called The Raggedy Ann Show, produced by Paula Stone. She was the hostess of it. And Gigi Pearson and I were Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy. So it was a 3 times a week program on KHJ, although we recorded it at NBC, since it was...
What, were they puppets? Or?
No. It was just a radio show.
I see.
Yeah, well, of course, Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy are the traditional puppets, but we were just doing the voices. This little story or series, which was sponsored by RCA Victor Children's Records. So we went on for 39 weeks until a musician's strike caused the demise of the sponsorship of the program for a while, because RCA couldn't record anything. Then I went on the road with a Horace Height unit for a while, doing my ventriloquist act at Dick Contino's show back in the Midwest. And I left that after a few weeks and went to New York and went into one of the first of my starving eras, pounding the pavements, going from producer's office to producer's office. That was in the... I think that was around 1949. And
what were you selling? A lot of different voices, or
Mainly character acting for.
Character acting.
Yeah. And I had my ventriloquist dummy with me too, and I would occasionally get a job over in New Jersey on a weekend, or up in the Catskills at a club, or something like that. A friend of mine who had been in the service was a producer for Ted Mack, the Amateur Hour, the original Amateur Hour. We'd been in special services together in California. And so a couple of times he got me a paying job on the Ted Mack show, radio and TV, in which I'd use a different name, and supposedly I was one of the amateurs. They always kind of spiced up the amateur talent.
What Chuck Barris does.
Yeah, the amateur talent with some unknown professionals, mm-hmm. just to give it a little spice. So that helped foot the bills. And then I got a call from a friend of mine in California while I was in New York the first time. Joan Gardner. And she had just gone to work for Bob Clampett. And I don't remember, yes, I remember how I met Joan. Long about 1947 or 8. At that time, I'd gotten to know Jerome Hines, a Metropolitan Opera singer, and he and Joan were very good friends. So it was sometime later, while I was in New York, I kept in touch with Jerry Hines, and I hadn't called him in a number of months, and I just got the inspiration one morning to give him a call, and he said, "I've been trying to reach you. I'd gotten a letter from Joan asking me if she knew where you were. She thought you were in New York but didn't have your address. She said there's something about a producer who's going to be doing a new puppet show, and she'd like you to contact her. Maybe you'd be interested." And of course I was interested, because I was down to nothing just about. So I called her, and they sent me an airline ticket on TWA. This was back in the propeller days. And I gave up my little one room in mid-Manhattan and flew back to Hollywood and went to work for Bob Clampett.
Had you known who Bob Clampett was?
No, I didn't know anything about him. I think I'd heard of Tom Pervini. And, of course, I'd known Dawes.
Through radio.
Yeah. Dawes and I were in a thing called the Afro Refresher Course, which was for GIs who had had professional radio acting or announcing and who wanted to brush up on their craft. So it was kind of a workshop. And that's where I had met Bob Light, who was the director of it. He's now the, and has been for years, head of the an association called the Southern California Broadcasters Association. Well, he was sort of in charge of that for what was then AFRA, now AFTRA. And I became a member, and that's where I met Dawes and Jim Hawthorne and quite a few people in the business.
As you can see from that list that I sent you, I've interviewed a lot of people that have worked with Clapper, so I've heard a lot of stories. Tell me about the Buffalo Billy show, because no one else has commented on that, because I haven't spoken to Joan.
Oddly enough, today I was working with Walker Edmiston, and he and I, Joan, Walker, and all of us were working together on this. Well, first Buffalo Billy, we worked for 6 months in Clampett's garage developing this show, practicing. And
was this garage like a little studio kind of?
He had developed his garage in the back of his house on Detroit Street into a little puppet stage workshop. So he finally got it on the air in New York on WCBS-TV, sponsored by Fanny Farmer Candies. So it was a half hour every Sunday afternoon live. And I was the voice of Buffalo Billy, and was that Pop Gun or was that Walker? It's funny, I don't even remember now. But we went on for 13 weeks, but I was under contract. So after 13 weeks, the show went off the air, and everybody went back to California except me. So I had about another 13 weeks to go on my contract, and he kept sending me money, and I was just doing nothing but living in a hotel there in New York, still under an exclusive contract to him, to Bob Clampett. So he dropped my option at the end of that cycle.
So he was almost forced to pay you because he had a contract?
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't try to get out of it.
Yeah.
I think I was making the fat sum of $125 a week, if that. Maybe it was $100.
Well, that's pretty nice for not doing anything.
Well, in those days, you could live on that.
Yeah.
So, and I couldn't work for anybody else. It was an exclusive contract,
yes.
So I kept practicing.
I've heard a lot about those exclusive contracts with Clowns.
Yeah. Anyway, he dropped me, and then I was freelancing again, trying to get a foothold in New York. Meanwhile,
was that the last you had ever worked with Clampett then?
No. Meanwhile, Charlie Shows.
You came back and did the cartoon voices, that's right.
Well, I came back for Charlie Shows, who had worked for Clampett, writing Beanie. He started his own series called Patches, The Adventures of Patches, on what was then KNBH, now KNBC, Channel 4. So we did that live for, I don't know, 26 weeks or 39 weeks. It was a pretty good run, but it was something under a year. And then NBC dropped that. And so for several months, I was freelancing again, and until Clampett decided to hire me once more. And I went to work on a new show he was starting down at KTLA called Flyboy. I don't know whether you have that in your notes or not.
No, I don't.
Beanie was being moved from KTLA to KTTV. Mm-hmm. So, because Clampett still had a contract with Klaus Landsberg at KTLA, he had to develop another show to fill that niche. So, it went on the air called Flyboy. Joan Gardner was the voice of Flyboy, the boy, little boy who went around getting in all kinds of adventures with his a little jet plane. Jets were something new in those days. It was a prop jet, I guess, Jato pod, they call it, thing, jet-assisted prop takeoff.
That was one of my mind teachers.
Oh, really?
He was Anton Hodek. The thing is that he never remembers any of his students, so I don't bother to say hi to him anymore.
Well, we did Flyboy for a while, and eventually it got dropped, and Clampett moved us over to KTTV, where he had set up his offices by then. And He had something like 3 or 4 live kid shows on, finally, daily. We had, of course, Beanie was going strong at 6:30. We had Thunderbolt the Wonder Colt. Buffalo Billy was on in the afternoons at noon. I think it was noon or 12:30, I forget which. So for quite a while, Joan and I sort of wrote an outline script daily for Buffalo Billy, put it together ourselves. And then we worked on the evening shows, and then there was a big once a week Willie the Wolf show, variety show, with puppets and people. And
you work with Walker on that.
Yeah. Well, I worked for Clampett, I guess, for about 6 years when I went back. And then we did a show at KTTV, even after we were no longer under contract to him. It was a Willie the Wolf thing, live, nightly. I was the announcer and did... I think it was just Willie. Walker did Willie, of course, and I would occasionally do the other hand and arm up through the cape. But I was his foil as the offstage announcer voice. And I think I did some writing on that, too. Well, anyhow, I was with Clampett, again, as I say, for about 6 years until the advent of cartoons for television started to come along. First of all, the thing that kind of spelled doomsday for live puppet shows on stations like KTTV and KTLA was the fact that studios like Columbia and so on were releasing their backlog of theatrical cartoons for television use. So we had the Popeye stuff where you would just have a single host like a Tom Hatton. Yeah.
Where you used to have to go to a theater to appreciate something like
that's
that.
Right. And so the local stations were no longer paying out a couple thousand dollars for a live puppet show package such as Clampett would put on. The budgets kept getting cut more and more and more till I think we were doing one of the shows for about $750 a week. Well, there's no profit in that for anybody. And finally, the whole thing just took a big fat nosedive. And so I started making the rounds again, going to the cartoon studios such as MGM and Warner Brothers, not knowing that. And that's when I first met Joe Barbera and O'Hanna, not realizing that MGM was about to close down its cartoon department. And that what Joe and Bill were looking for when they started talking to me was a voice for Rough and Ready. And they asked me, do you know Charles Shows? I said, oh yeah, I used to work for him. He was going to be writing it. You know Dawes Butler? I said, yes, Dawes is one of my oldest friends in Hollywood, one of the first people I got to know. So they were just trying to put together a compatible team, and it finally turned out to be Dawes and me on Rough and Ready, which was the first regular thing that I got back into after having left Clampett's.
I haven't seen Rough and Ready in a number of years.
Well, it hasn't been. I don't think it's been on since.
Yeah.
But that was the first series that Hanna-Barbera did on their own, and Oz and I provided all the voices. And
it's funny, I would remember that. The theme song to that more than I would the voices.
Really?
Rough and Ready.
That's right.
Yeah, I know the whole song.
That's it. So, from then on, I've worked, still freelancing, of course, but I've worked for Hanna-Barbera. And other studios too, but mostly for them. Every year I've done something, usually several series, for the last 21 years. Currently, We're doing more Scooby-Doos. That's been going on for 8 years now. And I was the voice of Godzuki on the upcoming Godzilla series, which goes on next Saturday morning, September 9th.
I have a list. Let me just read some of it over. And
all right.
You can help me verify some of this.
Yeah.
Ricochet Rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you did Ricochet Rabbit?
Yeah.
Sheriff, bing, 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 Ricochet Rabbit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, now, a lot of those characters, did you develop the things like the echoing of the bullet?
Usually,
in that particular character?
Yes, well, it wasn't my idea. Usually,
did it just come out like a mistake?
No, I don't even remember how it came about. Usually, Joe Barbera would have an idea of some kind of a gimmick such as that. Because of the name Ricochet, naturally, it was an obvious thing. He said, well, can you do something like a bullet ricocheting? I mean, I don't remember the conversation, but... it was an obvious thing, and so the...
Bing, bing, bing!
I threw that at him. I don't know, it's a sound that I've done over the years. And so it clicked.
So you kind of worked that into your dialogue, and every once in a while it came out.
Well, every time he'd say his name.
This is a job for... Yeah.
Bing, bing, bing! Ricochet Rabbit!
Yeah, right.
Yeah. All right, how about Moby? And by the way, if there's anything you can say to describe this character, you know, as I mentioned some of these, that would be helpful to me, because that's something that Dawes did, and I found that when he began to describe who was Yogi Bear, you know, what kind of person was he, that was really interesting to hear that.
Well?
How about Ricochet Rabbit? Is he kind of an innocent kind of...
Well, he was... He was pretty smart. He wasn't one of these dopey... Well, after all, his sidekick, Droopalong Coyote, was played by Mel Blanc. He was a slow-thinking, dopey kind of guy. So Ricochet Rabbit, who was just a little feisty guy, but a straight shooter, honest and upright and all that. He was a brainy little guy.
That show was pretty successful. Went on for quite a while then.
I think so. I wish it were still going on, but it hasn't been around for years.
Now, this one I'm not familiar with. It's more recent. Moby Dick and the Mighty Mitre. Scooby the Seal?
Yes, I did that, and I did the sounds of Moby also. It was just kind of an underwater... I guess.
Yeah.
Well, that was during an era when they were doing a lot of adventure type, like the Herculoids.
Which was just not too long ago, right?
Just
5 to 10 years ago?
Maybe? Yeah. Yeah, probably about 10 years ago.
The Perils of Penelope Pitstop.
Uh-huh. That
was one of the Anthill Mob.
I was several members of the Anthill Mob.
That's right.
I was...
Zippy, Pockets, Dum-Dum, and Snoozy.
That's right. Zippy, Pockets, Dum-Dum, and Snoozy. I wouldn't have remembered those names myself.
It's a good thing I wrote them down. And Paul Winchell was Clyde and Softy.
Yes. And also Muttley was in there, so I did the snickering dog Muttley along with...
Is that the one?
And
with
he
the,
was... Yeah. Like, he was Dick Dastardly.
Can you do that laugh for me?
Oh, sure.
Oh, there you go.
Resin, fresh, son of a...
Do you smoke at all, or does that just come natural?
Well, I used to smoke, but that comes naturally. Yeah.
I know some of the bigger announcers, they'll smoke. I kind of wonder if they do that for their voice quality.
I don't think it's... No, I think they smoke because they like to smoke, or it's a nervous habit.
Yeah, yeah. The Peter Potamus show, you were...
The monkey.
Yeah, he was just a kind of a feisty little guy, too.
Well, very often, as is obvious, I wound up being the second banana on a lot of shows.
They cast you. I begin to see that you are a lot of second bananas to Dawes.
Right, because
Paul.
They would very often like to cast the lead character with a voice that is already familiar to the public.
Yes.
And I don't do impersonations. So one of the few lead characters that I do or have done is Scooby. Mm-hmm. And he's not an imitation of anything, unless... You might say is an imitation of Astro, which I did on the Jetsons.
Yes, yes. Look, they look alike.
Scooby-Doo, as played by Astro. But it's basically the same type of growly voice.
Now, rough and ready. Can we jump to that?
Yeah. I don't know what else I can.
Now, rough. What kind of character? How would you describe rough as a character?
Well, again, he was sort of the quick-thinking, brainier counterpart of the team, whereas Reddy, who was a forerunner of Huckleberry Hound, Reddy was more the bungling type of guy, and so he, Ruff would be trying to set Reddy straight in the various adventures they would, he would be the one that would get things fouled up. Ruff would have to extricate him from the problems.
Also on that, I was Professor Gizmo.
Oh.
Yes, with a little top hat and walrus mustache. And the narrator on all the
I
episodes.
I recognize you in your natural voice as a narrator. I almost expect to be watching a Jellystone Park Yogi Bear. Mm-hmm. Now, Scooby-Doo, where are you? Now, that's their big, almost their Hanna-Barbera's Mickey Mouse, isn't it? Considered their the big character now? Scooby?
I don't know. It's one of their biggest.
I heard that, you know, that they call that their Mickey Mouse.
Really? I've never heard them say that, but I'll take your word for it.
What do you think makes that character so popular? I mean, it's just a dog, right?
Yes. Well, of course, the kids can identify with the teenagers who go around in their mystery machine, a van that they travel in. Well, I don't know. Scooby is a cowardly Great Dane, or, as I usually say, an adequate Dane. And he and Shaggy, played by Casey Kasem, are kind of a team together. There's Scooby. Yeah. Hi, Scooby.
Hello.
Want a Scooby snack?
Do I?
Okay. What makes him so popular? I don't know, but I'm glad he is.
Space Cadets.
Oh, yeah, that didn't stay on for terribly long, I think.
Countdown and Cup Star.
Yes, and seems to me I was something else.
You work with Lucille Bliss in that.
Yes,
I just met Lucille Bliss at this reunion. She came to that.
Uh-huh.
And I've got to know her pretty well since then. She's an interesting lady.
Mm-hmm.
The Grape Ape?
Great Grape Ape. Well, I didn't do any regular on that series.
You just did incidental kind of voices?
Yeah, on maybe about half the episodes. Bob Holt was the voice of the ape. However,
I have one of my books that says Dog Butler did the ape.
No. It was Bob Holt.
It's a good thing you mentioned that. Wally Gator, you were Twiddles.
Mr. Twiddle. Yes, he was the zookeeper, and Dawes did Wally.
And it was similar to the Mr. Smith and Jellystone
Park? Not really. No, Ranger Smith was pretty much my straight voice, a little more nasal like that, you know.
No, Mr. Twiddle, he was more like that. He was
more of a befuddled type and easily confused by Wally, who was always trying to escape from the zoo.
Wheelie and the Chopper Bunch.
On that, I was... was that character's name? She was only about 3 years ago. He was the little guy, the littlest of the motorcycles. I can't remember the character's name.
But, never written down. Yogi Bear, of course, you were John Smith. And you say you did that with a little bit...
I was the ranger. I didn't know his first name was John. That's the first time I've known that.
What they have down in my book.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I was Boo Boo, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, Boo Boo Bear.
And Mr. Ranger. Yogi always called him Mr. Ranger. He didn't call him... I think once in a while he'd refer to him as Ranger Smith.
How would you describe Boo Boo as a character?
Boo Boo was warm and friendly, naive. Not simple or stupid, just... kind of naive, honest, and trusting,
childlike,
childlike.
And oddly enough, I think, and Dawes would attest to this, because often when he'd be doing personal appearances alone, they would ask, "Where's Boo Boo?" Mm-hmm. And I think the kids, well, to them, Yogi was funny.
Yes.
He was the funny guy. They loved him. But they could identify with Boo Boo as maybe being a counterpart of themselves with this crazy oaf of a bear Yogi. But Boo Boo was just a simple, naive, trusting, honest, and would never do any wrong, would never think of stealing a picnic basket. And
it's probably the character you did the most down at Hanna-Barbera through all the years, isn't it?
Gee, I don't know. Scooby's been going on, as we say, for 8 years, so it's probably
neck and neck with that.
Yeah. And then I was Bam Bam on the Flintstones for 3 years. That series had been in prime network time for 6 years, and they introduced Bam Bam to be a playmate with Pebbles, I think in the third year.
I was Bam Bam.
Bam Bam.
Yeah.
Ooh, good appetite.
The amazing Chan and the Chan clan.
Yeah.
You were Choo-Choo.
Oh.
Choo-Choo, the clan dog.
Oh, yes, the dog. That's a dog I'd forgotten about.
And he was, what kind of dog was he, similar to?
No, whereas Scooby is a big dog, this one was just a little yappy kind of a thing, as I recall. It's more like a little terrier.
The Adam Ant Show, Secret Squirrel Show. You were Adam Ant.
Not originally. Howie Morris was the original Adam Ant, and then in the second year they decided to do, I think, about six or eight more episodes, and Howie was not available, and so. That's when I did it.
How would you describe Adam Ant character? You did it in
Hero. Yes, he was an ant like Superman.
Mm-hmm. Up and Adam.
You know, strong, little and squeaky, but still virile and savior of mankind and animal kind and any kind.
Precarious pup?
No. Precious pup.
Precious.
Precious pup, yes. Well, that was the same voice as Muttley and Mumbly. He's been through several incarnations. So, Precious Pup and Granny Sweet. Granny Sweet was played by Janet Waldo. And I was Precious. Again, it was the... and he was always getting it. I was... let's see, Shag, I guess was his name. Shag Rug. He was the little boy bear.
And he kind of talked like that, you know, had a southern accent. And he was the only one who could understand his pa. And his pa...
You know, Henry Corden did that. Was just kind of a mumbling thing as paw bear. And so I would translate whatever his mumbling message was.
Bailey's Comets.
That was a DePatie Freleng. I did one of the villains. I think that Dawes and I were the Jekyll Hyde twins. And he was Jekyll and I was Hyde. And then I was one of the good guys too. I think
he had kind of a southern accent, but I forgot his name. He was one of the cousins, one of the good guys.
The Banana Splits.
I didn't do anything on that.
You didn't?
No. There was a mini...
You did Snork? It has it down
nope.
in one of my books.
Nope.
It's just funny how, that, you know, that book I've been getting all my information from, a lot of my information.
And, what book is that?
It's wrong. It's called An Encyclopedia of Television, Volume 1, Volume 2.
I don't know who did it, Snorky, but... gee, I'll have to look for that, but that is not correct.
As you down. The Three Musketeers?
Yeah, I was one of them.
Aramis?
Sounds right.
Aramis,
yes. Yeah, that was just a pretty straight, heroic type voice.
The Micro Venture, Professor Carter.
Yes, we only did maybe 6 episodes of that, but...
Didn't work out so good.
I don't know. Sounded good.
Now, I'm Beanie and Cecil to the cartoon. What voice did you do?
None. No. I did not work for Clampett at that time.
Oh, see, it has you down as doing that also.
No.
Yeah.
Never worked on that.
Hmm. The book is really wrong in a lot of ways. The Buffalo Billy Show, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And what characters?
Buffalo Billy.
Buffalo Billy.
And...
What was his character?
Chief J. Eager Hoo-Hoo. Buffalo Billy?
Yeah.
It was very much like Ruff of Ruff and Ready, and very much like Pixie Mouse of mm-hmm. Pixie and Dixie. A nice, sweet little kid who came out to the old Wild West to live with his aunt and uncle. Let's see, Pop Gun, and I can't remember the old crackly voice that Joan Gardner did for the aunt. But Buffalo Billy was a little city kid who just loved to get out there in the Wild West and dress in the cowboy togs.
Around the world in 79 days?
Oh, yes, yes, I was...
Happy and Schmurky.
Happy and what?
And Schmurky.
What was Schmurky? Was that a dog?
I have no idea.
I don't remember. But as I recall, maybe he was a monkey. But I was happy that he was kind of a chubby photographer that traveled with them around the world.
Dastardly and Mutterly and their flying machines.
It's not Mutterly, it's
Muttley.
Muttley. Dick Dastardly and Muttley and their flying machines. Yes, I was Muttley, of course. Again, it's the snickering hound.
I think Clunk and Zilly.
Clunk was one of my favorite characters. He talked in sound effects. He said a few words, but... And Zilly was a real nervous guy who was always hiding in his trench coat, very cowardly. But he, like Shag Rug with Paw Rug, Zilly was the only one who could understand, or he would translate. Dastardly and Zilly and Clunk were always trying to catch the pigeon. I was also the pigeon, but all he ever did was toot his trumpet off key. He was always carrying a message that the
Jay Wardish.
Yeah, that the team of Dick Dastardly and Muttley and Zilly and Clunk were trying to capture, get this the secret plans. So Zilly was Clunk was always coming up with a new scheme of how to catch the pigeon. He'd say, "Well, boss, first we'll..." All kinds of... And and Dastardly, Paul Winchell, would say, "What did he say? What did he say?" And then Zilly would come out of hiding and translate, "Well, boss." And he'd explain what the latest razzle-dazzle scheme was that Clunk had come up with. And I really enjoyed... That was one of my favorite characters. They couldn't write. They would just... I'd try to spring the sound effect noises off whatever the preceding line was. But the writers would just leave it up to me to whatever,
that's pretty nice.
make the noises.
I trust you.
There's no way they could spell it or write it.
Mm-hmm. The Flintstones, of course, you said bam, bam.
Yeah, not a lot of incidental things. I was sort of the roving fielder there. Every script would have a call for just some one-shot characters. So people like John Stevenson and myself would do, they're permitted to do, they're permitted 3 voices for a single paycheck. If you go into a 4th voice, then it becomes double scale, and then you can go up to 6 voices for double scale. But, so they always try to get people like Dawes or John or those of us who double and triple like that.
Yes. Hobby, the Rebel's Pit, and Schlurp Rock.
That was when we did a series called Pebbles and Bam Bam, with Pebbles and Bam Bam as teenagers. By then, Jay North mm-hmm. was Bam Bam, and so...
I was bad luck Schlurp Rock.
He was sort of a picture of gloom. He would walk around with a... not a cloud over his head, but wherever, whenever he would walk into the room with the other teenage characters, bad luck would strike. It never would strike him, but everybody else. He would say,
Miserable day, isn't it? I'm so happy.
Of course, it's a similar voice to the Professor Gizmo from the old. It's just, it was a little bit higher
and younger. And the zookeeper and Wally Gator, similar.
And the what?
The zookeeper.
Well, yeah, no, there's a similar placement, but not quite with that sort of thing.
Frankenstein Jr. and the Impossibles.
Oh, that was back in that
multi-era
of... I was Multi-Man on what series was that?
Frankenstein Jr. and the Impossibles.
Oh, the Impossibles, yes. Well, I wasn't... See, that half hour was made up of... two or three. I wasn't on Frankenstein Jr. Well, maybe I was on a couple episodes, but I didn't do a regular on it. But within that half-hour framework, they had The Impossibles, and it was Paul Frees. I think Hal Smith.
Yes, I
myself.
Hal Smith.
Yeah. And so I was Multi-Man. He was just a pretty straight heroic. They were all heroes, but the particular knack that Multi-Man had was he could duplicate himself. So the villains would never know which was the real one to shoot at or try to catch.
Hong Kong Fooey.
Well, I was the striped cat named Spot on that. And mostly all he did was react to the stupidity and clumsiness of HK, Hong Kong Fooey. He was the hero. He would always extricate Hong Kong Fooey from his problems, but Fooey would always get the credit for it, but it was the cat who really did it. And then he would just look at Hong Kong Fooey and say, yeah, just reactions of dismay and disgust.
Now, are you both Pixie and Dixie?
No, Dawes was Dixie.
Yeah.
I was Pixie.
I have it in the book that you did both Pixie and Dixie, and of course Dawes had mentioned he did one of them.
So. He was Dixie, with the southern accent. And Pixie had was just straight, high voice. He was the one with the bow tie. That's how we could tell him apart.
And they were just two little nieces.
Right, yeah.
The Jetsons, of course, Astro.
Astro, yeah. Uniblab, who was on a couple of the episodes, he was a robot. And a lot of incidental characters, but Astro was in all the episodes. Do you know, here's a point of trivia.
Yes.
Astro's real name?
No.
There was an episode in which, on the Jetsons, George Jetson had to go to trial in order to keep Astro, because Astro's real owner, a very wealthy, and I've forgotten his name, had appeared on the scene and wanted his dog back. Well, by this time, the Jetsons loved Astro, and Astro loved them, and he was sobbing and crying. In fact, Astro talked so much on that episode, and the next one we recorded the next day, that I lost my voice for 2 weeks.
He did talk, didn't he?
Oh, yeah!
I can see how you lose it down there.
So, now my voice is much stronger. I can sustain the Scooby thing, which is similar. Much longer, whereas before I couldn't. Anyhow, it was during that trial that the former owner, the real owner, the wealthy owner of Astro, referred to his dog by its proper name, which is Trowelfaz. I love that. Trawlfaz, Trowelfaz.
Now, you were the announcer for the Jetsons as well.
There's no announcer
on
the Jetsons. No.
I thought I heard your voice
name. Well, sometimes it'd be a straight
the
voice
Jetsons
for
family,
some...
Yes.
No. Unless I've forgotten. But there was no running narrative as on Rough and Ready or some of the other series.
Josie and the Pussycats in Outer Space?
Yeah, I was...
Sebastian and Glee.
Yeah, Sebastian was the cat. And Bleep was a little outer space character. He didn't really talk. He just made kind of... strange noises.
It's fun to get a paycheck for doing that, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
Now, has there been some that we missed on this list?
Probably. I...
Can you think of some others?
Well, as I say now, there's some new things coming on, starting next Saturday,
yeah,
the new series. Godzuki on the Godzilla thing. Godzuki is sort of a, like a doggish counterpart of Well, he's more of a flying lizard is what he is, but... Whereas Godzilla, which is voiced by Ted Cassidy, is a big... You see, Empire State Building. Godzuki is more of a little guy. He's only about 11 feet tall, and he travels around on the ship and is the pet, the mascot of the ship, and playmate of the little 12-year-old boy who travels with his aunt, who owns the ship, and they're always getting in some sort of hot water trouble and have to be saved by Godzilla. And Godzuki, well, Godzilla is his hero. He admires and looks up to, but then who doesn't? Anybody looks up to Godzilla. So he tries to emulate him in his own feeble way. And he gets into a lot of fumbling scrapes, gets into trouble and has to be saved. But very often, he will be the one that will pull the real trick that solves the whole, that wraps up the whole caper at the end. It'll be through some, what appears to be a dumb thing, but it works out right after all in the end, and it's because of Godzuki.
Kind of an Astro kind of voice?
He doesn't say any words at all. No, it's they're more reactions. Well, I don't like to do
it. It's difficult to do it without a...
Because some of it is very loud and screeching, such as when he's calling Godzilla to come to their rescue.
He does this big roar.
Yeah, but it's all more of an animalistic type of thing. But I had to perform each one of them rather than making a stock library of sounds that they could...
To react to each different situation.
Right. But we do them separately from... They'd have the human cast record that. And then sometimes I'd be doing an additional character.
Add it to the tape to react to
right.
The grunt
and they
situation.
Would edit all of that together. So there's that, and let's see, do you have down the All-Star Laugh Olympics? That's been going on a couple of years. I was the sportscaster, offstage announcer on that. And in addition to a lot of the older characters that were part of the three teams, the Yogi Yahoois, the Scooby Doobies, and the Really Rottens. I was Dinky Dalton, one of the Really Rottens, and Muttley was part of the Rotten team, and Scooby was in there, of course, Boo Boo occasionally with Yogi, but I was the straight announcer describing the activity. Also new starting next week is Challenge of the Super Friends. And I'm a couple of villains on that. The Scarecrow, who has a very wispy voice like that. And I took over a role that Vic Perrin had been doing, but he went to Europe for a lengthy vacation, and so I became Sinestro, S-I-N-E-S-T-R-O, that he had, I don't know how many episodes he did of it. Similar situation occurred, do you have Johnny Quest down there, that series? Well, they started out with John Stevenson being Dr. Benton Quest, and Mike Rode was Race Bannon. Tim Matheson was Johnny. Danny Bravo was the little Indian boy whose name I forget, character. Well, I was just doing the yapping of the dog on the first six episodes, and sometimes other characters, a villain or a good guy. But for some reason, because everybody was shouting all through that series, they decided that John's voice and Mike sounded too similar. As Dr. Quest, Dr. Benton Quest, and Race Bannon. So, after six episodes, I was brought in to do the remaining 20 as Dr. Quest. And that was a good series. And that was a very straight, heroic type of thing. Whereas Race was the real hero, Dr. Quest was the scientist, and it was more of a thoughtful thing, but still... adventurous. So where are we now?
Well, you're trying to think of some more of your,
oh, yes,
the things we don't have to this list.
We referred to Godzuki on the Godzilla thing.
Were you one of Snap, Crackle, and Pop?
Yes, still am, currently.
Yeah, I suspected you were.
Usually Crackle, although it has varied and they've never tried to keep... Crackle, right. There have been a couple of commercials in which somebody else did Crackle and I was Snap. Usually Dawes is Snap and I'm Crackle and Paul Winchell is Pop. Although sometimes it has worked. They have never tried to really identify a particular voice with these three particular characters. Usually the agency attitude, which is unusual to say the least, is that, oh, well, it doesn't matter, just so they're different.
Yes.
Nobody ever really stops to think who is Snap and who is Crackle, yes, and who is Pop. And there have been times when, I guess, Paul Winter wasn't available and they had somebody else in there. Mm-hmm. I think even Hal Smith was on one of the commercials. But usually Dawes and I have been on all of them.
Do you say these kind of things at all?
No, I'm not. I suppose
I found a few of them that have that do that, you know, to collect all those things.
If I knew where to get one, I might. But
yeah. I think these particular ones you could send away by the back of the package. If
oh, you really?
But that would mean you have to eat, you know, those Rice Krispies.
Yes. Well, that wouldn't be too painful, I guess.
Can you think of any other ones?
Oh, let's see.
I have a character I brought along just to see if you can, because Dawes didn't remember who it was, and I thought maybe you might.
Oh, I think that's something that Howie Morris did. A series that he and Al Melvin did for Hanna-Barbera. But I can't remember the name of the character.
They were hillbillies, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. trying to find his name.
I think maybe that's what that series was.
I also have a
Ricochet Rabbit, yeah. That's him, all right.
I do trace all this stuff down.
Very good. Well, I can't think of anything else to add to it. If I had my booklets, I've kept notes of everything I've done since I've been in California, just about in the past.
Do you have a family?
Yeah. Yes. My son is still a college student, Humboldt, and.
Does he want to get into voice at all?
No. He's majoring in botany and would like to be a naturalist photographer. And he's spent most of the summer in the High Sierra, backpacking, camping, and a couple of weeks on a botanical field trip in Switzerland.
Sounds nice.
Yeah. And my wife is in Sutter Creek. She runs an overnight guest accommodations place there. So I'm sort of all over California. We have a place in Arcata, where Humboldt State University is, for as long as our son is a student there.
And so you spend part of the time up there?
Like Sutter Creek. Well, usually...
Is it woods kind of area?
No,
Sutter
it's...
Sutter Creek sounds like it's...
No, Sutter Creek is more of a small... It looks like a New England town. It's an early gold rush western town, about 45 miles east of Sacramento in the Sierra foothills. But it's a pretty little town. So I sometimes drive or fly up there about every other weekend or so, for a long 4-day weekend, usually. And
do you have any particular hobbies that...
My prime residence is in Montecito, and I have a recording studio there. So I do a lot of local advertising agency production work, which is fun and kind of pays for itself up there. So that's my hobby, and I like to swim and bike ride, but I seldom have time to anymore. Spend much of the time on the freeways back and forth, the 83 to 86 miles, depending on where I'm going, coming to Hollywood.
You have the right car for it. I used to have one of those.
Oh, yeah.
Built to last. You mentioned one son, only one son. Are you a cat and dog man with a lot of animals around?
Yes, well, I have a 13-year-old French Basset at home whose name is Gus, and he's waiting for me to return right now, and I should soon be on my way. But I've had him since he was a little less than a year old. So he's a good friend.
Say, I won't keep you much longer. Could I ask you to sign some things I brought?
Yeah.
And I'll add it to the collection. A lot of the things that I brought, about half of these, if I would donate to June Foray. We recently had a cell sale.
Oh.
And
I didn't know that.
Are you familiar with that at all? A SIFA?
No.
Do you know about a SIFA at all?
The American Society of Cartoon. Well, I know.
International Animated Films or something like that.
Yes, I'm vaguely familiar. I've
and
been
we
asked.
We had a cell sale where we had different studios. Hanna-Barbera was the leading donator to this cause of cells to sale. Sell to, for this.
The cell sale. Cell.
Yes, for this.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.